come on up, Jeff. Sorry, I don't want to delay you. But I just want to say how Tuesday, as an elder, I think all the elders would agree, Tuesday night's meeting was a blessing to us. And you'll hear more about that later. But I guess we can acknowledge that as elders and that we feel blessed because of that.
So we've been in the midst of a series in the book of Acts that's been going on for a while now, and we get to one of these big breakpoints in the book of Acts. And so it's worth sort of pausing before we get to the breakpoint to think, what's the story so far, right? So the story so far, it's like, you know, previously on Hill Street Blues moment, right? So previously in the book of Acts, right, what's been going on? Jesus had his ministry on earth. He goes up to heaven, right? The apostles are all gathered around, don't know what's going to be happening here, and then the Holy Spirit comes down and the church starts. So could you turn the volume, Bill? This is just killing me up here. And so the church starts, and then, you know, it sort of starts, and Peter preaches a good sermon, a bunch of people gather together, and then we get this series of progression of just sort of the church gets bigger, and then there's persecution, the church gets bigger, and persecution, the church gets bigger. And then we get this moment we hit about 3 weeks ago where suddenly the persecution gets really extreme. Stephen is martyred, right? And after the martyr of Stephen, the church scatters, right? So suddenly Jerusalem empties out, and you imagine the empty church now in Jerusalem. Suddenly people are all over, and that seemed like it was kind of like, wow, this is kind of a depressing moment. But then we realize, sort of as the story goes on, that the church scatters, and then churches start popping up all over the place. So now we've got like this church in Jerusalem building. It gets compressed. People scatter all over, and it's like a virus, right? It just starts popping up here and there and all over the place, and you can imagine this faith now spreading throughout the land. And then you imagine the poor people that didn't like the Christians. Now they thought they'd won here. They thought they'd beat Stephen. They kill Stephen. They think they've finally done it. The church in Jerusalem vanishes. And you can imagine how happy they're like, oh, good, we finally got rid of these Christians. And then they start hearing these reports. Oh, there's a church up there in Samaria. Oh, there's a church up there in Syria. Oh, there, and you can just imagine. And so then what do you do if you're sitting there in Jerusalem and you are trying to crush this church? Well, that's the story we get to in Acts chapter 9. Meanwhile, it starts. And meanwhile, while this church is spreading all over, meanwhile, Saul. Now, Saul we met at the stoning of Stephen. And we didn't meet him very much, right? He's just sort of standing there while Stephen is being stoned. He kind of collects all the coach, right? So meanwhile, Saul was still breathing out murderous threats against the Lord's disciples. Murderous threats. You imagine breathing out murderous threats, right? It's like this giant monster breathing fire is the image we get. Suddenly this horrific guy breathing out murderous threats against the Lord's disciples. He went to the high priests and asked for him for letters to the synagogues in Damascus, so that if he found any there who belonged to the way, whether men or women, he might take them as prisoners to Jerusalem. This is pretty dramatic, if you imagine. Here's a guy that's not just, I don't know why there's Christians, right? It's not that he just doesn't like, it's not even that he just wants Christians. He wants to murder the Christians. Murderous threats. And then he hears they're up there in Damascus, and he wants to go up there to Damascus. And what does he want to do when he gets there? He wants to go find all the Christians in Damascus. He doesn't live in Damascus, let's remember. But he wants to travel all the way up to Damascus just so he can find the Christians, so he can put them in chains, haul them back to Jerusalem, and then they can kill them. And you'll note, he doesn't just want to take, he wants to take the men and the women, it says, right? He wants to, you can just imagine, he wants to get the three-year-olds too, you can imagine, right? He wants to drag everybody back down Jerusalem in chains so they can all just be killed. Now, you imagine the scene we've just set up. This is a tension-filled moment for the church, right? The church has finally spread. It's popping up all over. And then suddenly you imagine Saul, with legal authority, starts roaming out to capture all the Christians, haul them back down Jerusalem in chains, kill them all, and we've got this giant conflict setting up. And if you're watching the movie version of this, this is that moment when you're like scared, right? Is this going to be a happy ending or a sad ending kind of movie, right? Now you may know, right? But you probably do know, right? But we can imagine sort of the tension of like, you don't know if I just walked into a comedy or tragedy here, right? And here's this guy with these murderous threats roaming in. You can just imagine the visuals on the guy with the murderous threats and the army behind him marching up to, and then all the poor little Christians sitting in Damascus just cowering in fear and scared. And you imagine this conflict. And then the question comes, how do you resolve this conflict? Because we all want to resolve the conflict somehow. And there's this great ways of resolving conflict that shows up in lots and lots of Greek plays, right? The great way, there's something in Greek plays of all these like divine, you know, these problems, right? And these like two opposing forces, and they set up this tension that cannot be reconciled. Like, how are we going to do this? And then there was the trope, and the trope was the Deus Ex Machina. There was like a machine that lowers down somebody from the heavens, and they're like the gods, and the gods show up and solve everything, and then we all leave the theater, right? And so this idea that God just shows up and fixes everything. Well, that's exactly what happens here. So Paul's there. He's on his way. Verse 3. As he neared Damascus on his journey, suddenly a light from heaven flashed around him. And so you can imagine, you're doing this in the theater, suddenly the bright lights get turned on. It's all sort of dark and gloomy and angry. And then suddenly the light comes on. The light from heaven flashed around him. He fell to the ground and heard a voice say to him, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" Now imagine, again, we sort of know what's going on here, but imagine this, right? You're just having Saul going along, and suddenly his voice comes saying, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" Who's being persecuted in this story so far? Nobody in flashing lights is being persecuted. And so Saul asks exactly the right question. Who are you, Lord, right? Like, who is this? And suddenly they're coming in this big flashing light beaming down and so on. "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting." Now, you've got to remember Saul here. Saul wasn't persecuting Jesus. He's persecuting all the followers of Jesus. Jesus is already dead, right? "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting," he replied. "Now get up and go into the city, and you will be told what you must do." The men traveling with Saul stood there speechless. They heard the sound, but did not see anyone. Saul got up from the ground, but when he opened his eyes, he could see nothing. So they led him by hand into Damascus. For 3 days he was blind and did not eat or drink anything. What just happened here, right? We have this story that we set up beautifully. I mean, Luke has done a brilliant job setting up this story of this giant conflict. We have the guy with the murderous threats. He's got the letters in hand. He's going up to drag everybody back down to Jerusalem in chains and going to kill them all, and it's all great. And suddenly a light shows up and everything's different. This metaphor of the light is extraordinary here. This idea that these lights are coming down from heaven. And what does a light do? Well, light shows up everywhere, not just in scripture, but all over the place. Light is an amazing thing. You know, if you ever just sit down and think about light, I mean, light is pretty amazing. You're in a dark room, you turn on a light, and what suddenly happens? You can see. You can't see without the light. With the light, now you can see what's there. You walk into a completely dark room you've never been in before. Until you turn a light, you have no idea what's in that room. You turn a light, and now suddenly you can see the whole room. It's really kind of amazing, too. We often think of light and dark as these opposites, but they're not at all. You go into a dark room with a flashlight, and you can turn light all over in this dark room. There is no equivalent for a light room. There's no flash dark, right? That you walk into a lit room and you flash darkness around, right? Darkness is the normal state. Light gets rid of the darkness, right? We saw that in the passage from John that Betty Ann read, right? So what happens in the story in John, right? And so John starts his gospel. And he says, the light of the world is coming, the light is coming into the world. Men live in darkness, and then when Jesus comes, the light comes into the world, and now people can see. There are so many praise songs about light, right? I mean, you could have had an entire service of like an hour and a half of singing, of just songs about, I saw the light, right? You know, just on and on and on about just sort of this idea that God being light comes in, illuminates everything, right? So it even permeates popular. I mean, you say, you're in a dark space. I see the light at the end of the tunnel is how he described. Like, it's dark, but I can see the light up there. That's where we're going. It's rescuing. And even the whole book of the Bible, right? The book of Genesis starts with let there be light, right? Light is amazing. So it's not a surprise in this story that sort of you imagine Saul, he's going in, he's going to persecute the church, he's going to haul everybody off in chains, and suddenly there's going to be this big breakpoint. Suddenly it's all going to be revealed, and it's light that comes. And here it is, light. Jesus Christ himself lighting up the world, and Saul sees the light, and he's blinded, and it all goes dark. This is not what light is supposed to do, right? Suddenly, Saul is blind, and everything is dark now. And then what happens? You imagine, it's just brilliantly crafted here, right? He's on, you imagine, he's got this army marching into Damascus. He's going to haul everybody off. He's angry. He's breathing murderous threats. The light comes. Suddenly, Saul is blind. So they led him by hand into Damascus. We go from the guy breathing murderous threats, coming to arrest and kill everybody, to the blind guy being led by hand into Damascus. Sort of imagine, he can't even walk in by himself. He has to be led by hand. And then he is blind and in darkness for 3 days. And he's not eating, and he's not drinking, and this is not the story we were set up expecting to see. We have this giant light, and suddenly everything goes dark for Saul. Hold that thought. Because then what Luke does is he does another meanwhile up in the city of Damascus. And so this is that moment, right? It's a brilliant kind of cinematography, right? You get this moment, suddenly he's blind, and you're like, what's going to happen to poor Saul? And then there's the scene cut, and we go over to the new character, Ananias, whom we've never seen before, heard of before, and so on. So suddenly we got a new character, and you're already thinking, wait a minute, did I just walk into a different movie, right? You cut over to this other guy, Ananias. And the Ananias story is really weird in the middle of this. When you pause and pull it out, right? You imagine we got this great story about Saul, right? Saul's going to be a great story. I mean, he's a great character, right? Murderous threats, standing there. He's going to do all this stuff. Now he's blind. What's going to happen to him? Suddenly we cut over to this other guy, Ananias. And you're like, why in the world are we cutting over to this other guy, Ananias, right? Why do we need him for? In Damascus, there was a disciple named Ananias. The Lord called to him in a vision. Ananias. Yes, Lord, he answered. This sounds very Old Testament-y, right? Calls to Samuel, God's always doing this, calling people, and then they say, yes, Lord, right? The Lord said to him, go to the house of Judas on Straight Street and ask for a man from Tarsus named Saul, for he is praying. In a vision, he has seen a man named Ananias come and place his hands on him to restore his sight. That's the command God gives to Ananias. So you imagine Ananias, he just wakes up one day or he's asleep or whatever, right? So there's this vision, and God says, go over to a guy named Judas's house on Straight Street, right? Straight Street's a funny name when you think, why would they have a name, a street called Straight Street? What does it tell you about all the other streets in Damascus, right? So there's Straight Street, right? And there's this guy Judas there. You're thinking, okay, whatever, we're going to go hang out with Judas on Straight Street, right? And by the way, there's this guy there. You know, he's just sort of, you know, he's blind. You know, and you're going to go, he's seen a vision. You're going to show up and give him sight. And this guy, his name, by the way, is Saul of Tarsus. But just go on over there. And you imagine Ananias seeing that and thinking, you know, God, maybe you haven't read the papers lately, right? I mean, do you not? I mean, I get it, right, God, right? It's not a blind guy, you know, healer, right? All of that kind of stuff. But do you know who you're talking about here? This guy Saul, there's something kind of interesting. Maybe you're unaware. Maybe I should tell you, right? Lord, Ananias answered, I have heard many reports about this man and all the harm he's done to your saints in Jerusalem. And he's come here with authority from the chief priests to arrest all who call on your name. God, this is not the guy you want me to go visit. There might be another blind guy somewhere you want me to go visit, but obviously you got it wrong here. And you think about Ananias, and he's exactly right. I mean, this is a weird command to be getting in a vision. Go find the guy that the one thing you know about Saul is he wants to kill you. Then just go knock on the door, right? Say, hey, I'm here. I'm a Christian. Is Saul here? And why is Saul in Damascus? Because he's looking for people like you so he can put them in chains, haul them back to Jerusalem, and kill them. And Ananias is told to just go do this? And you think, what would your reaction be if you're Ananias? It's not hard to think what your reaction would be. It's the same as my reaction. It's the same as any normal person's reaction, right? You know there's somebody who wants to kill you. You don't go knock on their door and say, by the way, here I am, right? You don't do this sort of thing, right? And in fact, you don't even do it if you know there's somebody going to kill you. But here we have a guy who's going to try to find all the Christians in town. Once he's arrested you, what's the first thing he's going to do? He's going to start finding your family and your friends, and he's going to start finding everybody you might have known, and he's going to put all of them in chains too, and he's going to haul all of you back to Jerusalem, the men and women. And you imagine Ananias, this is a terrifying command. You'll note too, God does not tell Ananias, go visit Saul, right, and it'll be okay. He never says that. He just says, oh, go knock on the door. He's seeing a vision, some guy's going to show up and give him sight. That's all he's told. And then what happens if Saul has sight? Well, he's got letters saying arrest everybody. And oh, hey, here's a Christian. You can imagine. I open my eyes for a second. I see this guy I'm trying here to arrest, and I'm going to put him in chains and haul him back to Jerusalem. We talk all the time in churches about living in this hostile world, right? We hear it all the time, right? And ever since I moved to New England, right? New England is a hostile place for Christians, right? There's a lot of people in New England that don't like Christians, right? It's a scary world out there. It's just hostile. Please, right? I mean, at some level, right? There are people around you that do not like Christians. They laugh at you if they hear you're a Christian. They think you're an idiot, and they mock you, and they laugh at you. Not one of them has letters from the government to arrest and kill you. Nobody is going to kill you because of your belief in South Hadley this month. I can say that with absolute certainty, right? You are under no legal threat of death for being a Christian. Ananias is under a legal threat of death for being a Christian, right? Paul's got the letters. He can arrest him and haul him back. And we look around and we're scared of people finding out we're a Christian because, hey, they might laugh at me. And Ananias is now being told, oh, okay, yeah, go talk to this guy. And he's not going to laugh at you, by the way. He's going to kill you. And Ananias says, are you kidding, God? Like, you got this all wrong. And then what does God say? But the Lord said to Ananias, go. This man is my chosen instrument to carry my name before the Gentiles and their kings and before the people of Israel. I will show him how much he must suffer for my name. Ananias says, you got to be kidding. I can't go see this guy. And what does God say? Go. That's all he says. And he says, by the way, this guy Saul, I got plans for him. He's my chosen instrument to go do all these amazing things. Notice he still doesn't tell Ananias she'll be safe. All God tells him is, I've got plans for this guy. You go. And now you imagine you're Ananias. Do you go now? And I dare say, it's not easy to be Ananias in this situation. Think of Jonah. Jonah is told, go to Nineveh. And what do we know about Nineveh? They kill people, you know, like Jonah in Nineveh. And Jonah hears, go. And what does Jonah do? Runs the other way, right? It's easy to imagine Ananias saying, find someone else. Look, once Paul or Saul, it's funny that Saul Paul is annoying, by the way. Luke suddenly halfway through Acts stops calling him Saul and starts calling him Paul, right? And you know, it's like a Greek and the Jewish name, right? And it's really kind of annoying. Like, can't you guys get one name, right? So Saul, I'll try to stick Saul. So Saul, right, is there, right? And I can imagine him saying, look, once I know he's doing all these great things, I'd love to go meet him, right? I would love to go meet the reformed murderer of Christians, right? That would be great. I'll have him over for dinner. I'll throw a banquet. My friends will all come. We can hear his testimony. It will be a beautiful testimony, right? He's got the best testimony ever, right? In fact, you can see so many Christians' testimonies trying to sound like Saul's, right? Before I was a Christian, I hated Christians and I persecuted them. Then I saw the light and now I love Christians, right? And that's a beautiful testimony. We all love hearing that testimony. And it's this model, right? And Ananias said, look, once I know this, I'm all good. I'm happy to go see it. But now, the guy still has never uttered a pro-Christian word in his life. The last thing he said was, I'm going to kill Christians, right? That was the very last words, right? And now you want me to be like, you know, I'll walk in and go see it. And you can imagine, like, what am I supposed to do? Do I go in and convert him, right? Am I supposed to walk up and say, I know you want to kill me, but please listen to me, right? And imagine now Ananias has to convince Saul not to kill him. What would he say? This sounds a lot like us. Like, how do I tell people I'm a Christian? I need to come up with a 10-point plan here for sort of before I can have that conversation, right? And you can imagine Ananias having all this anxiety. And then what does Ananias do? He goes. Then Ananias went to the house and entered it. He just does it. It's pretty amazing. He goes to the house. placing his hands on Saul, he said, "Brother Saul." Notice the brother Saul, right? This is a pure leap of faith by Ananias. "Brother Saul, the Lord," and then he has to explain who he's talking about, right? "The Lord, Jesus, who appeared to you on the road as you were coming here, has sent me so that you may see again and be filled with the Holy Spirit." Immediately, something like scales fell from Saul's eyes, and he could see again. He got up, was baptized, and taking some food, he regained his strength. Suddenly, scales fall from Saul's eyes, and he can see. Saul has been blind for 3 days. 3 days is not an accidental number, right? It's one of those magic numbers in Scripture, right? 3 days, right? We think about the Jonah. Jonah's in the belly whale for 3 days, but that's not the real 3 days. What's the real three-day analogy? How long is Jesus in the tomb? 3 days, right? There's a death, 3 days in the tomb, and then Jesus comes back to life. And we have exactly this happening with Saul. He is blinded, and 3 days later, he can see again. And it's kind of eerie when you're imagining now, suddenly he can see again, but the world Saul sees is totally different than the world he saw 3 days before. You imagine Saul before becoming blind, and how does he look at the world? And Saul after he regains his sight, and how does he look at the world? He goes from being the chief persecutor of Christians to the greatest missionary the church has ever had and ever could have in some ways. I mean, nobody could ever top what Paul did here, right? So he goes from sort of persecuting to preaching the gospel everywhere. He goes from having these letters trying to kill people to being under constant death threat himself. And yet under constant death threat, he keeps standing up and preaching the gospel and preaching the gospel and preaching the gospel. The world he sees looks nothing like the world he saw before he became blind. And that's key in this passage. Because what this story is trying to tell us is, there is this world out there we see. You walk around the world, you see the world. Your world has all sorts of things in it. It's got natural disasters, it's got political turmoil, you've got jobs or school, you've got people you like and people you don't like, you've got friends, you've got family, you've got football. I mean, you've got all this stuff in this world, right? And it's this amazing world, we think. And we navigate this world all the time, and we meander through it, and we talk about it, and we live in it. But there's another world out there, too. And in this other world out there, there's God and Christ and working through all the world and all these sorts of invisible things going on that we don't really just see as we're wandering through this world. And we've got this world we see, and we've got this other world that's just sort of, it's like overlaying it. It's there, but we don't quite see it ourselves. This is hard to articulate because this world we see is the one we can describe, right? But then the idea, we've got this world we can describe, but there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy, right? There's all this other stuff out there that's going on that just sort of, it's here, but it's hard to see. And so it turns out when people try to articulate what this looks like, they often end up writing stories, right? The Chronicles of Narnia is one long story saying there's a real world out there, there's a wardrobe there, but in the wardrobe there's this other world that's exactly the same as this world. It's got all the same landmarks and everything, but it's just slightly different than this world. The Matrix, the movie, is exactly the same thing. There's this world you're in, but it's like a video game, and then there's this other world, right? Every single book Neil Gaiman ever wrote is about this idea that there's a world and a shadow world, and they're laying over one another. I mean, he just keeps repeating it over and over. Huge sellers. So this idea that there are these two worlds out there, right, that we see one and there's this other one out there, I mean, this is there. It's there in Christian culture. It's there in popular culture. It's there. But how do we articulate it? Well, if I had to pick one person who tried to articulate it and did an excellent job, it'd be Jonathan Edwards. Sort of odd, right? Because we don't think of Jonathan Edwards as somebody who has sort of all these poetic kind of descriptions. But at the end of one of his sermons, it would have been great to sit around and listen to Jonathan Edwards' sermons, as we'll find out, right? He has a sermon called A Divine and Supernatural Light. And it's all about this light that comes in, and what do you see when you see this light? And he talks about all the light and everything about it, and then he gets to the final part, which is like, well, what does this mean for us? And he says, okay, we get this light. This light brings these benefits. First, this is the most excellent and divine wisdom that any creature is capable of. 'Tis more excellent than any human learning. 'Tis far more excellent than all the knowledge of the greatest philosophers or statesmen. Yes, the least glimpse of the glory of God in the face of Christ doth more exalt and ennoble the soul than all the knowledge of those that have the greatest speculative understanding in divinity without grace. The first thing this light does, you can spend your whole life reading great philosophers. You can read Plato, you can read Descartes, you can read Kant, you can read Nietzsche. I mean, you can read all these guys, and you will learn an immense amount. You can read the natural philosophers. You can read Galileo and Newton and Einstein, and you'll learn massive amounts about the world. You could have all of this understanding of the world and who we are and what's our place in it, and you could spend your entire life studying that, and you will still never see all the knowledge that's there. But this divine and supernatural light, it's like there's all this knowledge you'll never see. You flip on the divine and supernatural light, and suddenly you see all this other knowledge. Just boom, there it is. You don't have to study to see it. You flip on the light, and there you suddenly know more than you'd ever know without that divine and supernatural light. That's pretty amazing, imagining light giving all that knowledge. But there's a second. Second, this knowledge is that which is above all others, sweet and joyful. Men have a great deal of pleasure in human knowledge and studies of natural things, but this is nothing to that joy which arises from divine light shining into the soul. This light gives a view of those things that are immediately the most exquisitely beautiful and capable of delighting the eye of the understanding. This spiritual light is the dawning of the light of the glory in the heart. There is nothing so powerful as this to support persons in affliction and to give the mind peace and brightness in this stormy and dark world. Not only does it bring all that knowledge, you want to be happy, you want to find joy, you need that light. It doesn't matter how much you do, what you search for in this world, all the knowledge, all the experiences, none of that is going to make you as happy as this divine and supernatural light. And now we've got a light here that not only brings all this knowledge, it brings all this joy. And if you don't see that light, you have none of the knowledge, you have none of the joy. You see that light, you've got all this knowledge and all this joy. But wait, there's more. Third, this light is such as effectually influences the inclination and changes the nature of the soul. This knowledge will wean from the world and raise the inclination to heavenly things. It will turn the heart to God as the fountain of good and to choose Him for the only portion. This light and this only will bring the soul to a saving close with Christ. Not only when you get the light do you get all this knowledge, not only with the light do you get all this joy, with this light, your soul inclines to God Himself. The God of angel armies will be by your side. I mean, it's an amazing statement when you think about it. And what brings that God there? This light. Flip on that light, and suddenly you have that. And yet there's more. Fourth and last, this light, and this only, has its fruit in a universal holiness of life. No merely notional or speculative understanding of the doctrines of religion will ever bring to this. But this light, as it reaches the bottom of the heart and changes the nature so it will effectively dispose to a universal obedience, it shows God's worthiness to be obeyed and served. It draws forth the heart in a sincere love to God, which is the only principle of a true and gracious and universal obedience, and it convinces the reality of those glorious rewards that God has promised to them that obey Him. Not only does it bring all this knowledge, not only does it bring all this joy, not only does it bind you to God, it brings about an entire change in the way you want to navigate this world. And suddenly you realize this light is amazing. And you see it and you see all this stuff. And you don't see it and you don't see all this stuff. And you think, gosh, I'd like to see this light. I mean, it sounds like a pretty neat light, right? How do you see this light? Well, it's a divine and supernatural light. It comes down from the heavens. But the point of the story in Acts is pretty weird when you think about it. Because Paul has the divine and supernatural light come down on him on the road to Damascus. And what's the first effect? He goes blind. What's with the blindness? Why doesn't he just instantly see all this stuff? And you realize what's going on here. In order to see all this stuff, to see all what's going on, and to find the joy in it all, and to incline our hearts to God, first, we have to become blind to the world as we see it. We are so embedded in this world. We're terrified of this world. We're scared of this world. We live in fear of all the things going on. We have fear. We have trepidation. We have anxieties. We have all of these things. And until we become blind to all of that, we can never see the divine and supernatural light. And not only is this happening in the story of Saul very dramatically, it's exactly what happens in the story of Ananias too. These are twin stories, it turns out. Ananias, looking out at the world, is a scared Christian in Damascus, and he hears Saul is roaming up to kill everybody, and he hears, go talk to this guy, and he says, are you kidding me? I know what happens. And God says to him, nope, you got it all wrong. And Ananias first must become blind to the reality of Saul in order to go find the new and real reality of Saul. We have no hope of living those lives we all want until we become blind to all the things of this world. That's the first step, is to sit down and say, yes, I know there are things that terrify you. There are things that depress you. There are things that worry you. There are things that give you anxiety. But you know what? None of those things are the real things out there. They're the things in this visible world. This other world that lays over it is a beautiful and joyful place. And if you see that, when you see the hand of God working through everything, suddenly all those things that we focus on look totally different. That annoying person in your life is a creature of the living God. Here for I don't know what reason, and all the nature around you and the storms and the turmoils, somehow or another, this is part of a divine pattern of a beautiful and amazing world leading us all ultimately binding our souls to God. You want a prayer for the week when the anxiety starts hitting? Pray for blindness to this world. Pray that you will become blind to this world so that the divine and supernatural light can light up that darkness. Let's pray. God, we thank you so much that you came to earth, that you died, and that, God, that act allows us to see you.